The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning, and you're very welcome along to The Greg Hughes Show for this Wednesday, the 25th of February, 2026. It's just approaching 4 minutes past nine, and it's great to have you listening. Thanks so much. We've got plenty to keep you informed and entertained over the next 2 hours, so please do interact with us if you so wish. You can WhatsApp and text at any time, 086 60 25000, and we have new people texting the show every day because life changes, doesn't it, for people, and we become more relevant in terms of texting in from time to time for people. You can also give us a call on 07491 25000, 07491 25000, or email comments at highlandradio.com. and I want to invite you, if it suits you, if you're working at home or in the home, or maybe you have a congregated area in any setting at all, you stick the TV on, smart TV or Fire Stick. We're on the YouTube app, Highland Radio Ireland. The overwhelming majority of our guests join us via video, so you can see them too. And we're across Facebook and on the X platform as well. Right, let's have a look at the papers this morning. Let's see what's hitting the headlines. We'll start with the Finn Valley Voice. And believe it or not, the protest at Bord BHQ continues. Richard Moore, a farmer from County Cavan, a member of the Irish Farmers Association, is in the fourth week of a protest, first outside and now inside at Bord BHQ headquarters in Dublin. He's joined by five other IFA members, including Christine Friel from Convoy. She's still in there. The protest is in response to revelations about Larry Moran, the chair of Bord BHQ, and his ties to imported Brazilian beef. But as we heard, unfortunately, and this is no way to say don't protest, but as we heard from the Minister for Agriculture on this programme late last week, they ain't going to back down on this. It would be very difficult for them to get rid of Larry Moran, even if they wanted to. So it's a tough one for those protesting, because how is it resolved? And it's not like, you know, people often make comparisons to other protests that's happened historically. A lot of people aren't too interested in this one, if that makes sense. They should be, potentially, of course, but a lot of them aren't. So you're kind of struggling to get the headlines, because that's what you need. You need the public to know what's going on. Speaking to the Finn Valley Voice, Richard said Larry Moran's company, Dawn Farm Foods, imports Brazilian beef. This is troubling because, as chair of Bord BHQ, he's supposed to promote Irish food. When farmers heard this, it raised alarms. What do you think the solution to that is now at this stage? I mean, obviously, Larry Moran going might be one of those solutions. That seems increasingly unlikely. So is there an alternative whereby the IFA can feel, or those people can feel, they've succeeded in the protest? You know yourself. Right, the Irish Independent. Electricity prices back in the headlines again. And this one actually really is troublesome. Households, that's you and me, in Ireland, are paying almost twice as much for their electricity as data centres. Figures published by Eurostar show that data centres also have much lower networking charges imposed on them than those for households. Now, this is new news to me. I know they take 20-odd percent now of power, the entire power generated in this county, in this country. What I didn't know is they pay less electricity. I thought it was a reasonably level playing field in terms of how much the power costs. Well, Sinn Féin MEP Lynn Boylan said the situation where data centres were paying half of what homes pay for energy was grossly unfair. Ireland has some of the most expensive electricity in the Western world. The Eurostat figures reveal that households are paying on average 36.8 cents per kilowatt for electricity. Households pay 7.6% kilowatts for their network charge, but the big energy users, such as data centres, they're paying just 19.1 cent per kilowatt for their electricity supply and just 0.7% in network charges. Call me naive, call me ignorant, but I would have thought that they should be paying twice as much as we are, and in some way subsidising our electricity or contributing more to the development of the network. The reason there's big pressure on now to improve Ireland's electricity infrastructure is because the data centres are sucking a fifth of the power. And yet they're getting at half the price we are. That's not a good deal for the country, is it? Whoever set that up or negotiated that. Some of these stories are kind of follow-ons from a theme that's been running in the papers, and Irish neutrality, Irish military spending. It's kind of been on the agenda on and off for a couple of days. In the Irish Times, the front page, in fact, Ireland will buy hundreds of armoured vehicles and artillery pieces from France and will expand military cooperation with the country to protect Irish seas. The planned deal, which is expected to be worth up to £600 million, will be the biggest investment in army equipment in the history of the state. It will transform the Irish Army from a light infantry force with limited armoured elements to a heavy, mechanised one, equipped with modern armour, more powerful weaponry, and the ability to strike targets from large distances. Okay, so that's to protect our waters. Would we be making any unilateral decision to fire rockets from land to the sea of Irish waters, or might that be done in cooperation with other nations, which kind of feels like an EU army? Anyway, the story says it's part of a military modernisation programme that also involves acquiring a primary radar system to monitor Irish airspace. We do need this. New sonar technology, very important too. A new aircraft and ships to protect subsea infrastructure. Maybe even keep an eye on these boats that shouldn't be in Irish waters fishing. Another twist in a story that's incredibly tragic, but is also inevitably going to be made into a Netflix-type documentary. But as I say, in the first instance, this is a story of a tragic death. Armed Gardaí conducted a dramatic early morning raid yesterday and arrested the chief suspect, of, as the papers described him, in the murder of farmer Michael Gain. The officers swarmed the house where American Michael Kelly, 53, was living at around 7:30 a.m. in Tralee, County Kerry, and detained him. Mr. Kelly is being held under Section 4 of the Criminal Justice Act, which means he can be interrogated for up to 24 hours. This means he'll either have to be charged or released today. Mr. Kelly, a former US soldier, was previously arrested on suspicion of the murder in April last year. He's always denied any involvement in Mr. Gain's death. Garda sources described how the arrested man was shocked when officers arrived at his door at first light yesterday morning. Last year, you might remember, Mr. Kelly, who had worked on Mr. Gain's farm, was detained in connection with the death but released without charge due to insufficient evidence. On that occasion, he was held for 24 hours before being released without charge the following night. That is a story, and that is a very peculiar one. Even in terms of how it was investigated, how the deceased's remains were discovered, second time around almost. You know, there's a lot of questions in relation to that case. It has that kind of an intrigue. Back to sort of military spending, you could say. It's the Irish Daily Star. Sinn Féin opposing a €90 billion euro EU loan to Ukraine is tantamount to asking Ukraine to surrender. That's what the Taoiseach has said. Yesterday marked 4 years since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. As Taoiseach Micheál Martin said, the people of Ireland have opened their hearts. You've opened your homes and you've opened your communities for the 120,000 Ukrainian refugees that came here. Mr. Martin said it's extremely important that Ireland continues to show solidarity with Ukraine, and slammed Sinn Féin for opposing the €90 billion EU loan to Ukraine. But what do you think? Do you think this is? Do you think we can separate what this out what this money will be spent on in our minds? Like, are you satisfied that some of it's going to be used, obviously, to support the country in the time of war, but inevitably, and you can't figure out which parts, some are going to be used to buy weaponry to contest that war, to defend their land? I don't want to presume what people know. There is a trend, if you watch closely, whereby men in the spotlight who find themselves facing charges often of a sexual nature tend to find God. They tend to become very Christian. I've noticed some high-profile names all of a sudden, speaking very fondly of Christianity, even though they never did before, which the timing's interesting with everything that's going on with the Epstein files and what have you. This story's separate from the Epstein files, but still, it is quite the lifestyle change for comic Russell Brand. He had a Bible stuffed with post-it notes confiscated from him in the dock yesterday before he faced fresh sex abuse allegations. The rape-accused, born-again Christian, who's 50, had to surrender the holy book after attempting to read it and showing a page to an official as he took his seat in the crowded court. Wearing a fedora hat and gold and black tiger print shirt, unbuttoned to reveal a cross necklace, Brand had arrived at court in a black Mercedes, telling reporters he felt blessed There's a lot of people now at this stage have come out with accusations against him. He has denied them completely and has admitted that he was a bad boy back in the day, but nothing happened that wasn't consensual. But in the interim anyway, he's found God and has become sort of a, what people would define a sort of right-wing Christian influencer. All right, that was a run-through some of what is making the headlines and inside the papers. Our guest, our first guest, is Mary Coyle, manager of Donegal Cancer Flights and Services. And Mary was part of a delegation who met with Minister Dara O'Brien yesterday. This due to schedule changes under the new PSO contract. The key elements of that, it will cut the existing afternoon service to Dublin, which of course was vital for patients attending morning appointments at the capital's hospitals, and we had a good relationship with those hospitals in that regard too. But also the plane would overnight in Dublin. There would be concerns about it departing that busy airport on time, or perhaps maybe, well, the certainty of it being on the ground in Donegal would be lost, and what could come from that remains to be seen. So sorry about that long introduction, Mary. I just wanted to bring everybody up to pace. So how do you reflect on this meeting with the minister?
Well, I must say, Greg, that it was a positive meeting. We don't have all the answers yet, but I feel that we're all moving in the right direction. When we met with the minister yesterday, he is fully committed, and his officials, to fix this. They realise that they don't like where they are at the moment. We made our case very strong yesterday again that we were not budging. We weren't looking for more or less. We were looking just for what we had. And they took that on board. We're way past the review. They realise now there is no review needed. We have made that case quite clear. We need the flights as they are, the morning and lunchtime and evening schedule, with a plane base there overnight. So we're past the review. That no longer exists. They're just looking for a way now. They've had meetings with the airline. It seems the airline is willing to cooperate. They have another meeting now on Friday. They will look then at the legal implications, if any, and they will come back to us next week. But, you know, we're moving in the right direction. We made it very clear as well, Greg, that if we did not get the answer that we needed next week, we will be mobilising the people of Donegal and we will be back up at that gate. So we left nothing unsaid. He apologised. He apologised for the situation that we're in now. And we pretty much said, we don't need apologies. We need this fixed, and we need the contract. We need them to revisit the contract to ensure that this will never happen again.
And I think what was critical is that he and his officials understood the nature of this PSO and how it has sort of evolved into providing an essential link, of course, for tourism and business travel, but also for medical appointments. So it's not like necessarily other PSOs that we've seen. That has landed. He knows that now, okay? So that's good. You're not having to argue that.
Yeah, we don't have to argue that anymore. And that was very positive. And he kept saying, this is the only PSO we have in the country until Derry comes on board. So he wants to get it right. That was something that he said a couple of times yesterday. He wants to get it right. And so do we. So we're quietly hopeful, but it is like when we went to get a letter last year to do with the cap, so that this PSO would be outside the cap. We didn't rest until we had that letter. So it is the same way this time, Greg. When we have an official letter telling us that the schedule and the PSO is as it was, then we will be happy.
You talked about the legal implications. Look, a contract has now been signed. I presume the airline could argue that they are meeting the terms of that contract. And the government, obviously, at some point, their officials agreed that they were signed, scheduled to kick in. Did he give the impression that the airline is prepared to work with him? Like, in other words, that there have been meaningful engagements?
Yes, there has been meaningful, and that's where it all boils to money. It all boils down to money at the end of. But money doesn't seem to be a problem here. They're willing to pay for whatever it takes to get this fixed. I think the legal implications are, you know, if the airline, if they can't come to an agreement with the airline, that then it would have to go out to tender again. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that will not happen, that they will resolve this.
That would be a problem because, sorry to cut across, but just to bring those listeners up to pace, that would be a problem because this airline was the only airline that tendered for this route. So we can't get too tough either and throw it out because there may not be another airline that might be interested in taking this on either. So in other words, we have to be cautious and tentative a little bit too.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think where we left it now is that we all continue to work together to ensure we were able to give all the figures yesterday, how many people were flying, the cost of those flights to the organized or to the charity here. We didn't leave any stone unturned. We gave, you know, how many had signed the petition. They were affiliated to all the other cancer support centres in Ireland. There's 45 of them. We had letters from the other. So we backed everything up that we had been saying up to now. So I think we've done our bit, Greg, up to now, and it is for them now to ensure that they can fix this and that they will fix this.
And just finally, you mentioned next week. Is there what is the next communication or next update, or is it a meeting?
They told us that they would communicate the decision through our public our TDs up in Dáil Éireann. And can I just say, Greg, Donegal stood united yesterday. Every TD, the senator, everybody was there to back us up. Good. And it was a good united front. And I think at this point, they really don't have a lot of choices. They have to come up and show us that this is done.
Credit where it's due. It's good to see all the TDs putting aside party politics and senators to get it over the line. Okay, Mary, thank you for your updates. I do appreciate it. And thanks for all your efforts. Hopefully this is the first. We shouldn't have to be fighting for this stuff. So hopefully this is done and dusted soon.
No, it is very, we should not have to do this because at the end of the day, Greg, we all have our jobs and we all need to get on with our jobs. So putting those aside, we shouldn't have to do this. But as long as we get it done, we'll get over it then and we'll settle back into our normal lives.
Okay. In inverted commas. All right then, Mary, thank you very much.
Thank
indeed.
You very much. Bye, thank bye, you, Greg. Bye.
That's Mary Cole, manager of Donegal Cancer Flights and Services. So listen, we'll take a bit of positivity. I have great faith in Mary Cole to read a room. And I'm really getting a very strong impression that she is confident of a positive resolution. A caller believes, though, that maybe this is not going to happen. The minister will not restore the Donegal flights. It's all plamas, long finger politics. Well, you might remember on this show back when we were highlighting the surgical hub situation. I said on the show, long before the minister gave the very positive announcement that those plans would be progressing, that this is one of those that would get over the line in relation to the surgical hub. And thankfully, it was proven right in relation to that. And there's been others as well. This is one I do believe it's fixable. It can be a big win for the powers that be. For Darragh O'Brien, he probably wants to rehabilitate himself a little bit up here in the county, and why not? And also to both the government, politicians, opposition and independents are completely united in trying to push this along. So I understand your cynicism. I am one of the most cynical people at times you can meet, but I think on this occasion they're going to get it over the line. The next comment is one I don't really understand. But anyway, we'll be quicker, says a listener, going on the John McGinley bus than travelling to the airport from Greencastle, Mobile. The Derry route would suit us far better. Of course it would, but it's very important, especially us within our own county and region, understand that Donegal is a massive place, and even if you will never get one of these flights for whatever reason, it's very important that we support each other in retaining them. It's not either or. Derry's coming online, thankfully. Derry's coming online, and of course that's going to service Inishowen east of the county potentially more because of its location and its access. But Donegal's a massive county, and the west, it's a long way. You can travel 2 hours to get to the border at Kinloch or Bundoran, you know, from certain parts of the west. So we can have both. You know, we don't have to compete. We can have both. And Mary's working really hard on her end, and Derry also. Now, there is a protest stroke demonstration tonight. This is on the SNAs. You know, there had been proposals to cut SNAs from 200-odd schools. There was a strong opposition to it. I like the fact that we heard it first from the schools and from the parents because, you know, they were at this before the politicians got on board. But in fairness to the politicians too, they did apply their pressure as well. But this started where it always should start, the grassroots, the people themselves saying, right, this isn't right. Thankfully, there's a stay of execution, and hopefully the distribution of SNAs and that criteria is going to be looked at. It needed looking at for years. But in other words, any SNAs that are needed will be made available through the 26-27 school year, and there'll be no cuts. So that's good. But protests are still going ahead, and it's no harm, is it, to get together and send that message. You're being invited, if you wish, to support our SNA, Stand With Special Needs Assistance, Wednesday the 25th of February, 5 p.m, Market Square, Buncrana. It's proposed cuts to SNA allocations, which remain a concern, I'm reading here. And as I say, it's at 5 p.m, Market Square, Buncrana. And listen, it's always good for these campaigns to get political support. But I'll tell you, and I'm not talking to any particular campaign, if you overtie yourself to one political party or other, it can make it then more complicated and not necessarily advantageous to a campaign. But anyway, as I say, I'm not speaking of any particular campaign or other. Okay, now, this is particularly for those of you who listen to the overnight repeat, and we really do appreciate you doing so. But I've been a bold boy, and since the show changed to 2 hours, I've been putting the podcast up a different way and just changing a system. I have to do a physical thing. I'm going to be completely honest with you. I have to do a physical thing where I have to drag audio into a folder, and that schedules it for the overnighter. And I've dropped the ball a couple of times over the last week, and I'm really sorry. So your listening company is really important, but it's my fault. And I've put in place a system whereby that won't happen again. So if you are listening to the repeat in the early hours of Thursday morning, thank you so much, and my apologies for the inconsistency over the last few days. It's just me not dragging a file where I needed to. Right, now let us go to Tracy Kelly, who joins us on the programme now. Good morning, Tracy. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Greg. How are we?
I'm okay. Right, Tracy, what's your story? You can pick it up where you think it's important.
Oh, I don't even know where to start. So we're just out of hospital yesterday with my seven-month-old. He had RSV. We've been battling on and off with sicknesses in the house just since November. The kids have just been given an antibiotic every turnabout for throat infections. And, you know, it was just ongoing. And then after Christmas, I decided that I wanted them swabbed just to see, because I felt in my gut that it was something more than just a throat infection that was going on. So I got them swabbed on the 20th of January, and the results didn't come back. First result came back on the 30th of January, and the other two results came back on the 3rd of February. And it was all just a bacterial infection, I was told by the GP. So they gave me another antibiotic for the three kids, and it was a 7-day course. So they said when that cleared up, obviously the bacterial infection would be gone. So coming towards the end of their antibiotic, they all took sick again, and it was sicker than I've ever seen them before. So I rang them back, explained the case, and it was one of the nurses, and she asked who requested to get them swabbed. I was like, I requested them myself. I just felt that there's something more. So her recommendation was they needed a longer dose of an antibiotic to shift it. Mm. And I says, no, I'm not happy with that decision. I says, can you get me a letter for A&E? Because I'm just not happy. And she says, you know what? You can carry on to A&E. You don't need a letter. So this was the 12th of February. I took them all to A&E. Took the three kids to A&E that morning. And the middle son, now he was the worst out of the three of them at that time. We got up there and they were able to check them over. And when the doctor was able to read back over the swabs that they had got on the 20th of January, he was able to actually tell me that two of the older kids had pneumonia and they were close to sepsis. And the younger boy, Oshin, he had bronchiolitis. Now, they admitted, the second boy, Brogan, they admitted him that night because he was so bad, dehydrated, just totally lifeless. And when they took him to the ward, they were actually able to swab him again. And they were able to tell us that he had RSV and flu A. So he was put into isolation up there in the kids' ward. And we were told that our other two kids were more than likely to catch the same thing that Brogan had. So I asked them, you know, would there be any chance on keeping the two children and even putting them on fluids to flush it out? But they said it wasn't recommended to send them home, just keep them fluid, for me to keep up their fluids and keep an eye on them, and if circumstances changed, to take them back in. So Brogan got out on the Friday. Yeah, that was the 13th of February. He got out and things then just started to deteriorate at home. Oshin got so sick on the Saturday, the 14th. And that Sunday morning, in the early hours, me and my mum took him up to A&E and checked him all over. And she was able to read. They all got swabbed on the Thursday when they were up. So she was able to read his swab from the Thursday to tell me that he had RSV and he would be admitted to the hospital. So we got into his room. We got up at 7:30 that morning into the room in the children's ward, and the doctor's done the rounds and he was like, you know, what's your concerns? And I said, look, my child's vomiting. He's a high temperature that I can't control. He's dehydrated. He hasn't had a wet nappy in 12 hours. And he was like, right, okay, we'll try and get fluids into him to see how it goes. So at this stage, they had already tried to put in a cannula and they poked three times and they couldn't get it. So I just asked him, I said, look, can you leave it? And I will try my best to get his bottle into him, even if it's just water. So I started getting the water into him and he had one wet nappy in 12 hours. And when the doctor came back, he says, look, I'm happy to send him home. He's drinking. He has a wet nappy. Is that okay? And I was like, no, it's not okay. Because I know my son's not well. So the wee nurse came in afterwards and she was just like, right, you're for home. And I says, no, I'm sorry. I'm not happy with that decision. And she just rolled her eyes and she said, well, the doctor said that he is drinking and he now has a wet nappy. And I was like, yeah, but that's his first wet nappy in 12 hours. I was like, I can't control his temperature. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm not happy. I don't want to go home. So she says, do you know what? I'll move you to a different room. I'll check in with you in an hour or two and then we'll decide then if you're going home or not. And I just looked at her and I said, I'm sorry, but I won't be leaving this place today. So we got moved into the short stay ward. That was 2 o'clock on the Sunday that they were trying to send me home, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And at 6 o'clock on Sunday evening, my child was put on oxygen and he didn't come off his oxygen until there on Monday evening.
Wow.
So he was on oxygen a full 8 days. And they wanted to send me home. But I knew in my gut, I was like, I am not leaving, no way. Because I knew myself that he wasn't himself. But they thought with one wet nappy in 12 hours that they were just going to send him home.
And I'm so glad I stopped my gut. What deteriorated, Tracy, that he ended up on oxygen?
So with him not eating, not drinking, they were trying to control the temperature. And then his breathing, so they were checking all his stats and his oxygen was going down, his oxygen levels. So they put him on an oxygen mask on the Monday, and then there last Tuesday evening, my mum came up to let me go home and pack more bags because I had only packed like a few things for me and him. Mm-hmm. So I came down, I live in Cairns, so I came down here, packed a bag to get more stuff for us for the week. And I rang my mum to see was everything okay, and she didn't answer. And I thought, I've got a feeling again, something's going wrong. So when she did finally ring back, it was a nurse that was on mum's phone.
Oh, no.
And she was just saying, look, his stats had dropped again. His oxygen levels went really, really low. Mm. We have to change the machine. He's on an Airvo machine. I didn't take in what she said. Everything was just, all I heard was his oxygen had dropped. So I dropped everything at home, grabbed my stuff, and I went straight back to Letterkenny. And when I went up, they just explained that they had to change him to an Airvo oxygen machine. So that's like a dehumidifies along with giving him oxygen. So it was breaking down all the mucus and the phlegm that he had built up from the bronchitis and the RSV. And that night, before the changeover of staff, the nurse, she was lovely. She just explained everything about the machine and why they put him on it. And she did say that all staff are in red alert and ICU are notified about your son because he is that low.
Before, there's a few other questions I have, but, and I don't want to over dramatize the situation, but I'm just wondering if you had have gone home and his situation deteriorated quite rapidly, if that happened to be overnight, or if that happened to be, you know, not where you were able to, you know, say sitting on a couch daytime, we don't know what kind of a conversation we might be having now, I presume.
No, exactly. I didn't know what outcome that we would be having now. I said to her at the time, I was like, look, if he starts vomiting again or his circumstances change, what am I meant to do? I'm an hour away from the hospital. And she just says, well, you just come back. And I was like, that's all right for you saying that. I'm 1 hour away. If my child's oxygen levels start dropping, like... And she was just very bold and cheeky, and she was just looking at me and just, you just come back.
RSV
is... And that's
is,
when I was just like, I'm not leaving.
RSV is really quite common, but particularly in young children. A caller actually asked, what is it? It's a respiratory, it stands for respiratory syncytial virus. As I say, it's common, it causes coughs and colds, and often people will go to the GP with it, and the GP will say... they'll send you off and say, look, if anything changes, come back or go to the ED. So it can, in certain children, you know, they can become really, really quite sick. So what was happening with the RSV? It was causing, which it can do in your children, bronchitis or pneumonia or what have you. And that's really where the danger was, or did it worsen beyond that? You talked of a risk of sepsis. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so the risk of sepsis came from the swab that I got them to take on the 20th of January. But like, as I say, the GP didn't tell me what the bacterial infection was. They just said it was a bacterial infection and give me an antibiotic to clear it up. It was when I went to A&E, the doctor there was able to tell me that the bacterial infection was actually pneumonia in the older two. And close to sepsis, because he was shocked that I wasn't told of what the bacterial infection was. Mm. He was baffled. He couldn't believe it. So if I didn't take them to A&E that day, like, would they have got sepsis? Would they not have? Do you know?
Who's to say? You don't.
It's a million questions that I have to ask. I don't understand.
And the most recent podcast we've put out there is a story very similar to this, unfortunately, with a very tragic outcome for young Dara. And the message is know the symptoms, trust your gut. But we also need to ensure that our medical professionals have an eye out for this type of stuff as well. One wet nappy does not a well child make, I would have thought, and I'm not a doctor. Tracy, you talked of multiple courses of antibiotics. And still this infection persisted. What was it? What thankfully, and we're seeing a lovely picture of beautiful, happy Oisin. I presume he must have had a tube in his nose, did he?
He did. He had the oxygen tubes in, and then he had the feeding pipe in as well.
I was going to say, I just
because
recognize,
he wasn't taking his bottles. And
yeah, I recognise
his
wee
mark
from,
they when, couldn't get in.
From when Hudson was in.
Oh,
so what
yeah.
was it? What is it that actually then cleared this? Because, as I say, sorry, I just want to be clear. You did have quite a lot of antibiotics, probably too much, you could almost argue. So what actually ended up clearing the RSV?
Well, you see, they just say that it's a viral infection, so there's nothing that you can actually give them that's going to take it away. You can just aid them. So, like, Oshin, he needed oxygen, so that's what they done. They just give him oxygen and they give him Calpol-Nurofen just to help with the temperature and for pain relief for him. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing that you can actually give your children to help RSV. You know what I mean? You can just aid them with it.
Yeah, okay. All right, Tracy, listen, thanks for that. A very stressful experience. There's just no doubt about that. And actually also a little bit of shock and trauma from what could have been. Unless you're a robot, you're going to have to be feeling that, right? But the message you want to get across, and we've heard it before, trust your gut, advocate. If something feels wrong, you know, push back.
100%.
Okay, thanks,
Tracy.
Because
even if you're wrong yourself, you know, it's just a matter of the doctor saying, yes, you are right, or no, you are wrong. You know what I mean? Just go with your gut. That's the only thing that I can say anymore, because if I didn't go with my gut that day, where would I be today?
Yeah, okay. Well, we don't want to consider that, but we must. Tracy, thank you. Best wishes to the whole family.
No problem. Okay. Thank you very much, Greg.
Bye-bye. Look after yourself. Now, Minister of State with responsibility for small business and retail with responsibility for the circular economy, Alan Dillon. Thank you for joining us, Alan. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Craig, and your listeners.
I think, is it... before I get to those points, I want to know what the circular economy strategy looks like and what you hope to achieve with it, Alan.
Well, firstly, thanks for having me on, Craig. So yesterday we launched the second whole of government circular economy strategy for the next 3 years. And this plan sets out to both accelerate and deliver real practical action and targets to help Ireland move away from what we have currently, which is a straight line model where we take materials or resources out of the ground, we make a product, we use it for a short time, and then we throw it away. So this plan is very much focused on keeping products in use for longer, to ensure that we repair and reuse more, that we waste less, and also create good local jobs in the process. I suppose the way of doing things, you know, in recent times was in a straight line, but it's no longer sustainable, and for three reasons: for our environment, for our climate, and our economy. And it's also costing people a lot more money. You know, once upon a time, back a number of decades ago, we used to repair things, we used to reuse things, and in one sense, consumer behaviour and consumption levels have increased really significantly.
And just in relation to that,
we need a plan.
Yeah, just in relation to that, Alan, you can tease it out further. Like, I agree with you in that, you know, just in terms of the most basic thing in a house, dishwashers, washing machines, microwaves, dryers. I think we thought we were advancing and the prices were coming down, but the reliability wasn't there. And you'll have people listening who would have sought to get spare parts for some of these items, and the companies simply didn't make them because they perhaps were of the view it wasn't cost effective to repair them. You know, so really it's a case of almost going backwards a little bit in that basic example to go forwards.
And that certainly is the case. And I think this is what this strategy encompasses, really. It's about getting more value out of what we already have. And you know, if we're serious about, you know, tackling our climate, you know, then we need to do a lot more in regards to how we, I suppose, change our relationship with stuff and what we buy, how long we use it, and what happens to it when we're finished with it. Because, you know, when we look at climate, we only look at electricity and transport, but over 50% of all our emissions come from how we make and use materials, food and products. So in terms of our competitiveness, in terms of trying to ensure that we do things that have a meaningful impact, and we make smarter choices within our house, but also businesses make smarter choices. We need a strategy, and this strategy now has a statutory footing through the Circular Economy Act. We also have the Circular Economy Fund that's well established, that will support programs within this plan, and also we will have strong governance and monitoring, and I think that's really important. We want to look at the likes of piloting a national repair voucher scheme by 2027, and that will start with electronics, as you said. We want to make it the easy choice to repair items and make it cheaper to fix a phone or to refurbish a laptop. And we also need better choices to allow you to donate items rather than throwing them in the bin, and also to buy secondhand items. So we are looking to work with local authorities, with businesses, with NGOs. All the different stakeholders will have a responsibility. And we will have an oversight group that will be chaired at ministerial level that will regularly track delivery and remove any barriers. And this will remain a political focus. Because,
what do you think, what do you think the government or the powers that be can do to help us? Like, I left the recycle bin down on Sunday. I didn't. I got someone to leave it down. And it was packed. But it was packed with stuff I don't really want. It was packed with stuff that fruit or vegetables was wrapped in, or maybe that wasn't in there, maybe that went into the other. But anyway, boxes around boxes. Do you know what I mean? Like, say, for instance, if someone orders something online, like that bin was full of stuff that I don't want or don't need, even down to the trays that you buy meat on, stuff that maybe it's for marketing reasons and it looks attractive. But that bin was, I would say, three quarters of full of stuff I don't actually even want, Alan. So, and I think I'm kind of normal. So to some extent, in certain areas here, you're pushing an open door with the public.
Well, for sure. And, you know, since I've taken up this role the last year in regards to responsibility for the circular economy, it seems to be an abstract term for many who don't understand it. And we do need to change our habits and become more aware on how we actually deal with items and products and materials. And we've established a national communication platform dedicated to circular economy. And that's led by the Rediscovery Centre, and it's backed by our department and partners. So, like, it is very much about ensuring that we make good decisions, smart decisions, that we can ensure that repair and reuse becomes easy options, that even in the context of food waste, we still throw out so much good food. And we need a strategy, and this strategy very much pushes supermarkets, food businesses and households to halve their food waste by 2030.
No, I would do in that regard. And it sounds the most silly, stupidest thing is actually a public information campaign about how to use a freezer. I know that sounds so stupid, right? But freezing meat, chicken, steaks, stuff that gets chucked out because people get 5 for 20 at the butchers or something. You know, people don't know how to. I didn't know how to successfully freeze, store and defrost chicken, something as simple as that. A quick one on fast fashion, if you don't mind, because there is a culture now whereby people will buy 5 things from overseas in the full knowledge that maybe 3 won't fit and it's so cheap they don't send them back, or getting T-shirts for €2 or €3. How do you sort that out while making clothing affordable for all and not penalising those with the least amount of money, but also maybe curtailing this? Because you talk about the environment and all that stuff, not to mention us dumping tons of stuff in African countries as well. That's not a best practice. So is fast fashion, the area of fashion, an area, and are you committed to sort of dealing with that in a way that it doesn't also rob people with low incomes the ability to, purchase stuff?
Well, certainly it is a key area of focus, and this year we will be publishing the National Textiles Roadmap and Policy Statement for Textiles. And within that, we are working within the European Union for a European Enhanced Producer Responsibility Scheme. I think that will be important because many producers and retailers are exempt from their responsibility in terms of providing collection systems for returns. But also, the taxpayer currently picks up the tab for all the unused garments and clothing that we see are scattered outside the bring banks, because some of the bring banks and civic community sites, they're full to the brims. So there is a real challenge. Ireland is probably one of the highest consumers for online textiles. So we have a real challenge to do here. But what we will be doing in April 2028, we will ensure that producers help play for that collection, sorting, reuse and recycling.
Okay.
And we do need to provide a national separate textile collection system, and that will be introduced by 2030. So it's very much a key pillar within this strategy, and we know how important it is to ensure that we do have a network of secondhand shops and make it easier for households to donate items.
Yeah, well, and in a way that's where you can support maybe jobs and small businesses. Alan, thank you very much indeed. That's Minister of State with responsibility for small businesses and retail, with responsibility with what we've just been focusing on, the circular economy. We can go straight now to Christine Friel, who's the Donegal representative on the Irish Farmers Association Farm Family Committee. Christine, thank you very much for joining us. I do appreciate it. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Hello.
Hello, Christine. How are you? It's Greg here. How are you keeping?
We're keeping good. Greg, we're into day 23. We're in the reception in Bord Bia headquarters here. And still, suppose there are a pile of dialogue happened in the last 23 days, but nothing anywhere to get us home. So we're here for God knows how long.
We were speaking to the Minister for Agriculture late last week on the show. He was of the view that Larry Moran not only should retain his position, but a full endorsement of what he's done, and really arguing that, I think, farmers aren't looking at the bigger picture here. With that kind of an endorsement, how do you get a solution to this, Christine? Because surely you don't want to be there indefinitely either.
Absolutely, Greg. But the first question you have to ask yourself is, why is the government so basis to keep one man in a job and ignore the thousands of people on the ground that's calling for him to resign? That's the big question. What has Larry got over the government that's keeping him in his job?
Well, I mean, their argument is track record. You know, that we're talking about big deals. This is about big deals, big markets, and not really about the image of the Irish product. When I suggested that that's what it was, that, you know, you've got this guy whose job is really to say, you know, Irish beef is best, it's a quality product, blah, 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 but he's also important Brazilian beef. He was like, no, yeah, you're not getting it. That's what the IFA want you to think, but that's not what the story is here.
Absolutely, and there's a pile of dirty water coming up. We've learned that one of the directors here in Bord Bia, one of the marketing directors, has stepped aside or resigned. This was supposed to be in the pipeline for a long time, but it has only come out in the last few days here. So they're starting to jump ships, but Larry's hanging on for whatever reason, and we're going to stay here till we get to the bottom of it.
Before we get back to the issues, Christine, I mean, this is a remarkable protest you're undertaking. You've given up everything really effectively for the last month. What is life like in there? I mean, how do you pass your day? Where do you sleep? How do you occupy your mind?
We've definitely plenty to keep us occupied, because we're up in the morning and the next thing it's bedtime. We are interviews, the newspapers. Now, we have no coverage from RTE because that avenue shut down, obviously, by the government. We're sleeping and we have air beds on the floor in the reception in Bord Bia. Five of us here from all over Ireland, and we firmly believe what we're doing is right, and continue to do so until we get a resolution. And that means one thing is Larry steps aside or removes himself completely.
And that is the red line. There's nothing in between where we're at now and that resolves this.
No, absolutely not. There's in Clare Morris last week, there was up to 700-800 people all in agreement with what we're doing. A thigh last night in Martin Hayden's own back door, every one of them. And it was probably maybe more, they were furious last night and they were calling on him to resign because he's in a job that he's not taken anybody, only Larry. And they also called for the CEO, Jim O'Toole, to step aside. The anger on the ground has grown immensely, and we're in Cavan Crystal tonight. So get all the bums in the seats and head for Cavan to show the support. This isn't going away, and it's grown feet every day.
I mean, obviously, this started off as a protest outside and now has come inside.
Yeah.
Does there need to be a bigger mobilisation at that building to sort of, in other words, to be honest with you, especially if it's not being broadcast on RTE, you're in there doing bips and bobs with us, News Talk, whomever you might be speaking to, but it's very contained. It's a small number of people. No one's on hunger strike, right? So if you're working in PR in government, you can say, right, we can outlast these guys.
That's exactly what they're thinking is. One of the senior members in government has said that we could rot here. We can stay as long as we like. But that doesn't solve the problem. Board Bia is effectively shut down. All their staff is working from home. And they can't bring anything to the table at all that's going to resolve this.
Are there any plans for an escalation outside the building to back you guys up?
There is, and that's what the farmers is calling for this last week. But bringing tractors to Dublin closes the whole place up, and it affects everybody. But if that's what it takes, it was announced last night down in where Nice that they're going to bring Newbridge to a standstill on Saturday, and that was brought from the floor last night from the farmers there. They don't realise they're fueling everybody up with their arrogance, and they just can't see the behind or through Larry Murn. So whatever reason, but listen, as every day goes by, we're digging deeper and we're getting into the nuts and the bolts of it, and there's a lot of dirt coming out in the water. Okay. And I'm sure there's plenty more to come out as well.
Right, okay, well listen, Christine, we'll talk touch base with you again. Hopefully there's a resolution one way or other, because this is I know you're resolute, but I'm sure all of you want to be home with your families as well, and back on the farms, for crying out loud.
Absolutely. And listen, only for the support from home, we wouldn't be here. So a special shout out to my two wee fellas that'll be watching us after school, Hugh and Raya.
All right. Take care, Christine. Thanks so very much indeed. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Greg.
Bye-bye. Christine Friel there, Donegal representative on the Irish Farmers Association Farm Family Committee. Well, there is no wobbling there. Christine seems resolute. They are not going until such time as Larry Moran either steps aside or is removed from his position as head of Board Bia. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops now over the course of the next few days and weeks. You may have heard on the news the most heartbreaking of news this morning. We learned of a very serious road traffic collision in St Johnston last evening, and just in terms of the terminology and the information the Gardaí wanted to get out, it became clear that it was going to be a very serious one. And Gardaí have released this press statement saying they're appealing for witnesses following a fatal two-vehicle road traffic collision at St Johnston on Tuesday the 24th of February. Gardaí and emergency services were alerted to the collision involving a lorry and a car. It occurred at around 11:15 p.m. A male passenger of the car, aged 19, was pronounced deceased at the scene. His remains were conveyed to the morgue at Letterkenny University Hospital. A second male passenger, also 19, was conveyed to Altnagelvin Hospital, where he was later pronounced deceased. Post-mortem examination will take place in due course, and the coroner has been notified. The male driver of the car, also 19, was conveyed to Altnagelvin Hospital for treatment of serious injuries, and he was later transferred to the Royal Victoria Hospital in Belfast, and we wish him a speedy and full recovery. There are no other injuries at this time. Now, the R236 road is currently closed, this for a technical examination, and it's the Garda Forensic Collision Investigators that are on site. Local diversions are in place, and Gardaí are appealing to anyone who may have witnessed that collision to come forward. So road users who may have dash cam footage were travelling in that area between, say, 10:45 and 11:45 last night, are asked to make this footage available to investigating Gardaí. They will take the footage, the raw footage, and find what's relevant. If you have any information at all, please contact Letterkenny Garda Station on 074-9167-100. And just personally, to they won't hear this, but offer my deepest condolences to the family, the families of these two young men who have passed away. I'm so sorry for what you're going through and what you've had to endure and what will happen in what you have to endure for the weeks, months, years, lifetime ahead. And we wish the third occupant of that car a full and speedy recovery, but obviously, presumably for specialist treatment, he has been transferred to the Royal Victoria Hospital in Belfast. But we're thinking and praying for everyone affected by that. Right, now there's a new documentary going to be aired shortly. It is the Texas Ollie documentary. It's being shown this Thursday, in fact, on the Regional Cultural Centre. That's at the cinema, is that right, Emmett? Where is it being shown?
It's at the Regional Cultural Centre. It's behind in Green and Theatre, Port Road.
All right, okay, so that's happening on Thursday. Emmett, welcome to the programme. Thank you so much for joining us. So, Texas Ollie, what was it about and this story that you thought, right, there's a documentary in this?
Well, I met Ollie, I work in television, I'm a cameraman, so I met Ollie while we were making Love in the Country. And all the production who came in from Dublin, the director said, we're going to meet a cowboy in the hills of Donegal. I said, okay, great. And as soon as Ollie opened the door, I recognised him from Rafal, because I grew up in Rafal, and I remember when I was a kid, I remember Ollie being around town. So I got talking to him, and he just started telling me his story at breaks while we were filming, and over that time, I just thought, you know, this would be a nice story to document, just as Ollie being a son of Rafal and me being a son of Rafal, maybe just from a heritage point of view, just as a record of someone who lived in Rafal. So I talked to Ollie and I said, listen, I'll come back to you when I've a bit of spare time and we'll have a chat. And I wandered up to him one time, I was in Donegal, and I put a microphone on him, no cameras, and I said, listen, let's have a chat. And what I thought would be 20 minutes, I think lasted about 6 hours.
Wow.
And as the story went on and on, as Ollie began to tell it, I thought, right, this is quite the story. And when I went away and listened back, I thought, right, let's put this on camera and see how what we get, you know.
Yeah. So his story is, well, how would you sort of paraphrase it? You know, he's turned a passion, a love, maybe even an obsession of his youth into a reality, but not in Texas, right?
No, he did go to Texas, but he used to watch films in the cinema in Rafal when he was young. He said when like pre-10 sort of age, and he loved Roy Rogers, so he sort of had a big interest in that side of it, and he wanted to be a cowboy. He did eventually get to Texas. He went out there for 3 years as a singing cowboy, working on a dude ranch. And then he came back for a break, and he just decided not to go back. And he just stayed in Donegal.
Well, that's not the end of the story.
No, but then he started training horses. Yeah. While training horses, he would train them and pass them on. He came across this horse called Silver, and the two of them went on this extraordinary adventure that sort of changed his life and the direction of his life hugely.
Yeah, know? Okay. And how much of that can you tell us about it? Because, yeah. I mean, obviously, in this whole story, Silver, a horse, is a big character, right? And yeah. A big part of it. So as much as you're comfortable in letting us
know. Like there's people who know all of Ollie's story. There's people who know some of it and people know none of it. So Ollie became a trick trainer with Silver. He ended up buying this horse. He says himself the horse hypnotized him because he went to Enniskillen to a horse fair with no intentions of buying a horse, and no one else put a bid on this horse, and he was the one that bought the horse. He says himself that it was untrainable, and eventually Silver either he broke silver or silver broke him.
Oh, 50-50 maybe.
And silver then ended up picking up a peak cap that was lying on the ground, and this brought Ollie back to his childhood and the tricks. And they started working together, and Ollie wasn't trained. Ollie just had this bond with Silver.
And at what stage of Texas Ollie's life did he encounter Silver? Because he wasn't a teenager.
No, well, this is one of the things that resonated with me. He was in his late 50s when he started being a trick trainer. So that, to me, was quite...
Well, what I like about this story, you see, is that sometimes we can be our worst enemies and think that, right, you get to a certain age and that's it. Yeah. And yet here is the story of a man with a chance encounter with a horse, as it turns out, and his life goes off in a different path altogether. Another chapter, a whole other chapter. Still a young man, don't get me wrong, but sometimes we can be planning our retirement or demise or whatever it might
be. That opportunity that came up that Ollie was presented with by Silver, he followed that. And again, he didn't want to travel. He went into the circus in Derry. He performed around a few places in horse fairs, and he went into the circus in Derry. He didn't want to travel. But then he ended up, I think Silver took control, and he Silver really.
You've
was
fallen in love with the story, haven't you? This horse has hypnotized you, I think.
It's quite an amazing story, you know. Mm. And Ollie tells the story quite well. So and when I went up to record with him with the camera, it became a 4-hour interview. But we then got into a side of Ollie that he became very honest about his life and how he lived his life, and retrospectively now. At his age, looking back on decisions he made, things that happened, and how he is where he is now. So I think that again, was just organically came out as we talked.
Yeah, because we're talking about milestones spanning an awful lot of time with an awful lot of time in between.
Yeah.
For life.
Yeah.
And decisions. And
How
big of a leap was it, if at all, Emmett, for you, as a camera person, but you've worked on documentaries and many other different types of projects, but then sort of transitioning into actually being responsible for your own project, right? So shooting it, but also this is your vision, this is the story, you want to tell it, you know, you want to edit it, I presume, as well. So was it inevitable? Is it your first time doing your own project?
Yeah, it's the first time I've done a complete project. But when we work on documentaries, we would do a lot of collaboration with the people we're working with anyway, and we would be working not necessarily on the front lines of the story, but you'll be standing listening to what's going on and following what's going on and suggesting. So you would have a little bit of input, but the nature of the job is a very human interest, quite similar to what you do. You have a very human interest view on people, and when you turn up with a camera, people have the tendency to tell you an awful lot. So,
And a lot of your work much of your work has been in the factual space as well, too.
Factual, so we go across quite a bit, but factual reality, you know, I've been in it for 30 years, so I've seen a lot, you know.
I think actually when, after that program that you were involved in, I think Texas Ollie was on the show. I'm almost 100% sure I did speak to him, and he was a very brilliant character.
He's quite the character.
My time was fleeting.
Yeah, he is quite the character, and he loves to perform. You'll still find him around Glenties and Ardran, the local bars, playing, and he just loves a crowd. He loves singing. He loves getting out and talking to people and socialising. So he is, and he has a good story to tell. So he's quite the character to hang around with, you know.
Yeah, so obviously, as we've mentioned right at the top of this item, it's being shown on Thursday at the Regional Cultural Centre at 8 p.m. In terms then of a wider distribution, are you there yet? Do you know what you want to do with this? Maybe you've already got plans?
Yeah, to be straight with you, we don't have a distribution. We never even thought that far. Yeah. This is only the third showing of it. The first one, we did a premiere in the Vault House in Rafoe for family and friends. For me, that was Ollie, two sons of Rafoe, myself and Ollie going back home and showing this film. It went to Galway last week, which Ronan McCarron from Rafoe was involved in bringing it to Galway. And then the RCC said they would run it after that. I have no idea where it's going to be. We don't have distribution. It's all totally self-funded by myself.
There's so many options now, either self-publishing or... God knows what. Anything I missed out, Ahmed? Because as I say, you know, I like to give a sense of what people can go and enjoy, but I hate when too much is given away either.
Yeah.
You know, to me, but it's clear Texas Ollie is a fascinating character. And anytime you sit down over a prolonged period of time, you know straight off, and you knew when you mic'd him up that this guy had a story and he had to engage you for all of the time he was speaking to you, because that's what you know you can bring to your audience, right?
Yeah. It's like sometimes when we're filming, our job is to make the camera disappear. Mm-hmm. And when I talk to Ollie, for me, the camera disappeared because I got so engaged with him talking and his story. He's very, the honesty, his look on life and his belief in himself and his belief in the journey that you can go on is quite the story, you know, and it comes across quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much stuff out there and I'm not critical of any of it, but, you know, I can only hear the same story about the same celebs a certain amount of time, right? Yeah. That's just me. You can't beat stories of people. And I was going to say ordinary people, but the truth is actually a lot of people, if not most people, are actually extraordinary. They just haven't had the opportunity to tell their story.
Yeah.
Now Ollie, obviously, he's pushing the boundaries, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who have stories like that. Mm. And Ollie, even now, he ends the documentary on quite a positive note. Like, he's still waiting for his next adventure, you know, what's going to happen next, you know? So from that point of view, there's quite a message for us all in it, you know?
100%. The mind, our mental health, our physical health, our attitude, they are all intertwined. I've seen it far too often in my life not to believe it to be true.
Yeah.
And if you look and plan and think of the future, you're giving yourself a good chance of reaching it, I think, often, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's some brilliant stuff. Congratulations, Emma. It's great to get it out. It's great to get it done. I know you're flat out, but this, when something's your own, it feels a little bit
absolutely
special, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's great to get a reception of people, you know, loving watching it and getting the message from it, and that's what I want. You know, I wanted to get out and for people to see that this is quite the story, and
it's gut confirming. You had a gut feeling, and you've had
and some people take something away from it when they leave, you know.
So it's all about Texas Ollie. It's a true story of Ollie Hepburn, a Donegal man who turned a childhood love of cowboy films into a real life as a horse trainer and performer. But there's so much within that story in and of itself too, which will add to the experience for you if you get along to the Regional Cultural Centre. It's at 8 p.m, the showing, on Thursday. And you can get in contact with the centre to book a ticket.
Because you can book a ticket, or you can pay at the door as
okay,
well.
Okay, good, excellent. That's a good option as well. So that's something different for you for this Thursday. Emmett, thank you so much for calling over.
Thank you, Greg.
Emmett Hart. Now, this is Esophageal Cancer Awareness Month, and this week is National Lollipop Day. We'll talk more about that in a mo. With Jamie Timoney, who's ambassador for esophageal cancer in Donegal, from Donegal, living and working in Galway. And we were speaking beforehand. Have I got that correct?
Esophageal, that's the only thing, but don't worry about it. It's spelt different ways and it's
of course, and often, I mean, they know the medical terms, but this is why we end up with little ways of describing them, don't we? You were diagnosed with esophageal cancer in 2023. So what is it? Where does it affect you? And we can sort of follow on from your diagnosis from there.
Well, an easier word for the esophagus is the food pipe. It's just the pipe that would take from the throat down to the stomach. It's about 30 centimetres long, and it's the main transit point to get any food into your system. And for something so important, it can be easily overlooked when there are any symptoms there with cancer involved within it. So I had about 6 months of symptoms from June until December 2023, and they could be so easily dismissed and put aside. But eventually in December 2023, I was sent in for a scope, just to find any kind of source of bleeding, because I had quite low hemoglobin and iron in the blood. And there was a 10 centimetre tumour at the base of my esophagus.
And what was it being put down to? Stomach ulcer, reflux?
Well, there was thought that it could be... the main symptom I had was heartburn, and I'd never had heartburn before in my life. And a small tablet could get rid of the heartburn instantly. Mm. So that could be dismissed as well. So many of the symptoms, you know, a pain in your chest when you're eating can be alleviated when you eat a little bit slower.
Yep.
Hiccups, coughs, hoarse
voice. And also your age, right? So this is the elephant in the room here, because I presume they would look at you, ask about family history and go, right, it's probably not going to be that because, you know, and this is why we're talking to you. This is to dispel any myths and to make sure people don't disregard symptoms. You would be very young for this cancer or any cancer for that matter, thankfully.
Yeah, I was 34 whenever I got diagnosed and every doctor I spoke to was saying, you're too young for it to be anything significant or sinister. I had a family history of esophageal cancer, but there was no real genetic link that's been pinpointed. They're actually studying it quite a bit at the moment to see if there is some kind of genetic link within it, but there's no evidence. But I had so many doctors say, you're far too young for that to be anything sinister or significant in that way.
It didn't help, did it? That lifestyle changes were working for you in the first instances, you know, cutting out certain types of foods.
Well, tea, I had to cut out tea for too long. It was, it was things like that they could pinpoint. And then, like I said, the medication I was put on got rid of the main symptom that was giving me any kind of bother.
When they found the tumour in through the scoping exercise and told you, did it come out of the blue or had you sort of semi-prepped yourself or was this like, hold on a second, we were looking at something completely different here?
You know what, pardon my sense of humour, but when you look online for any kind of symptoms, it goes to the worst case scenario.
Of course
you've got cancer, you're dying or something like that. And of the 6 months, like I said, that I was looking up symptoms, it could be dismissed as maybe an ulcer or a hernia or something within your stomach. There was nothing. I remember going for the scope that day and I drove myself. I was going to brave getting the scope done without sedation and the doctor insisted on giving me sedation and he told me afterwards he knew what he was going to find based on my symptoms. Mm. And even when I sat there waiting, he wouldn't speak to me until my partner was there.
Mm.
And that still didn't click in my head that it was going to be something significant. Mm-hmm. I'm still maybe a bit loopy from the sedation, but you know, it was the sense of, I never once, you know, I left school the day before. I said to my 6 years, I'll see you tomorrow. We're going to go over this. And I never really saw them again in a classroom. Mm. You know,
the initial diagnosis, you had it for quite some time. Actually, before we talk about the initial diagnosis, you were bleeding internally.
Yes.
Right. And this was actually flagged by checking iron levels and other levels. I presume then at some point your body is consuming the blood because it's above the stomach. Is that why it's not obvious other than the fact that levels are dropping or what?
Yeah, because like I was functioning perfectly. Yeah. I was working, I was going to the gym, I was socialising.
You weren't noticing anything in the toilet?
No, absolutely not.
Sorry to be crude.
To be crude, it's one of those symptoms. Main symptoms is I was having darkening stool as time went on. And I'm not ashamed to advise people, check your stool.
So that did become a factor in it then?
Oh, okay, definitely. Right. But it happens so slowly and, you know, gradually that you don't really pay much attention to it.
And you're adjusting your diet and you've stopped drinking tea. And is that a factor? Right, okay, I get you.
Absolutely.
Were you lucky? You had it for quite some time. Is it a very aggressive cancer or does it depend on the type of esophagus cancer that you have?
Esophageal cancer would be known as one of the more aggressive and kind of life-altering. I know all cancers are life-altering, but, you know, when it's all the food and drink you have to consume for the rest of your life. I always liken it to a car. It's like your car, you need fuel to power the car.
100%.
But some days the car says, I don't want fuel or I can't handle that fuel. Mm-hmm. I might get very tired or weak eating. It is one of the more aggressive cancers that you can have based on the surgery and the treatment that you can have afterwards.
And is a stenting an option or is it?
I had my esophagus removed because that's the most effective, believed to be the most effective form of kind of it not reoccurring.
Because get it out of you altogether.
Esophageal cancer has a high reoccurrence rate in particular because of the length of the esophagus that there's so much area.
So what do they replace that with?
They pull your stomach up, believe it or not. Your stomach is tend to be in a bean shape, but mine is now pulled upwards to be kind of a pipe and a tube.
Unbelievable.
It is amazing, and it doesn't come without its complications.
What about that little valve at the top of your stomach to stop reflux?
That's gone. So now I have to sleep elevated. It's one of those things, you know, I can easily slip off a pillow and I wake up with a little bit of heartburn. I'm still on the medication, obviously, that would alleviate heartburn.
Mm-hmm.
But there are loads of different little lifestyle changes.
Yeah.
It's not it doesn't affect a lot in your day-to-day life, but it can affect certain things that are quite frustrating, like sleeping and eating. I don't have the little thing in my brain telling me you've eaten a little bit too much now, so I can suddenly get very tired and overwhelmed. I have to eat slowly and surely. And little things like that just kind of affect your day-to-day life.
Yeah, and you make decisions on a day-to-day and you take one for the team if you really fancy eating and you know the crack. And, okay, I get you. In terms of then it's spreading to other areas, I presume that's a concern with all cancer. Mm-hmm. That's a tough period for you, isn't it? Is it isolated? Yes. Has it spread somewhere else? Is it in the lymph nodes? What's the story?
Yeah, I was diagnosed with stage 3A, which I didn't know existed before my own diagnosis. But it meant that it was fairly localized in the esophagus, but they did notice that it was starting to influence some of the local lymph nodes. Now, they deemed that to be still a bit early doors, a break. So they were saying if you had left it another few months, it could have gone a little bit further. And they didn't really know until they removed my esophagus and did the pathology how advanced it would have gone. Mm-hmm. I had to do immunotherapy for a year afterwards because they weren't as happy with the lymph nodes as they thought they would be. Mm-hmm. So little things like that. But it can be quite... But when you think about it, you know, a 10-centimeter tumour on paper sounds like a lot.
I don't know what a centimetre is. How long is that?
Yeah, well, like, you know, when you think of a ruler...
Yeah,
it's 30 centimeters. Okay, a third of it. You know.
Okay, I get you. Sorry for being a dinosaur.
No, you're fine.
But
happy
anyway.
To answer any questions.
Yeah. Right. So that is really quite significant.
Yeah.
How? What? I mean, obviously, you're an ambassador, right?
Yes.
So, is it a case of what we've been doing up until now? You know, don't screen yourself because of age. Don't screen yourself necessarily because of family history. Don't always. We can sometimes in our minds put. It's very convenient to put it down to indigestion, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's far easier to deal with than it might be to pursue it a little bit. Okay, so it's to not ignore the signs. What we've been talking about here, really, would you say?
Absolutely, and that's the thing. It's like I've unfortunately had to learn that esophageal cancer is one of the sneakiest cancers, and the fact that you can be functioning until it's very well developed.
Yes.
I mean, heartburn. How many of us have heartburn just on a day-to-day basis? Mm. Wasn't there a pub selling Gaviscon, you know, behind the bar over it locally at one stage? Everyone gets it. Mm. People pop Rennies. But it's something that if it's going on for a long time, we would just advise people to consult their doctor. It shouldn't be something that's just left to kind of grow and fester.
Can I go back to the family history thing? Because that's interesting, because I presume just if there was any of it in the family, that's family history. But you talked about how, is it that in medicine at the moment, it's not associated with genetics? Is that what needs teasing out a little?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a doctor. I take
but it's just the sense of
my grandmother had esophageal cancer back in 2003, 2004. But it was never really considered one that could be hereditary in any way.
I get you.
There is a lot more research being done into it now based on family history. But it also could just be bad luck in many ways. Like I've lain awake at night wondering why, but there really isn't
a definite reason
and you'll never get one.
Yeah.
But it can happen to anyone, you know.
Yeah, I get you. And is there a screening for it? Like, I mean, have you found, I don't know if you have any siblings or cousins that are now going, right, okay, I wonder.
Luckily, I've got nieces and nephews and things that I would be concerned about, you know, like them in the future. Mm. But it's the sense of, I was luckily with the pathology came back that they didn't find a direct marker.
Understood.
That was in there that would
show it.
Okay. I'm referred on for a bit more genetic testing, but it's not something that we're overly concerned with at the moment.
Now, when you got your diagnosis, your dad was also going through cancer. Very sadly, he's passed away since.
Yes,
But in a way, a gift to you from him was knowledge and an understanding.
Absolutely.
Of the journey that you were going to have to go on. So in his medical situation, he was actually even helping you.
Absolutely. Mm. And it's funny because, like, you know, so many people that we know are affected by cancer, but I don't think you ever fully understand it or appreciate it until you are going through something similar.
Yeah.
But it's a sense of, like, some of the terms that I had that were gibberish to me, that he was saying he had gone for a PET scan. Suddenly I was going for a PET scan.
And
then
PET scan was,
I understood exactly what it was. And it was a very unique and strange bonding experience, but it was kind of comforting and devastating at the same time, probably, to be going through that kind of thing.
And maybe one of life's perverse gifts, almost.
Very much so, yeah. No, I feel like we had so many big talks that I don't think we may have had, you know, sharing experiences and understanding.
Well, that's a gift in and of itself, isn't it?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, well, that's how I would view it. Sorry, I shouldn't
very
be,
much
I shouldn't
no,
be
I agree.
Attributing emotions
I agree.
To you, but that's how I feel.
Yeah.
Right, okay. So what's this lollipop situation? I remember reading somewhere that they were looking at some point to help with diagnosis using lollipops. I presume that's unrelated, is it?
I couldn't guarantee that for you for definite.
Because with mouth... I don't want to dilute this story, but I think I did an interview about they're looking at a lollipop that can actually help identify oral cancers. But park that, because I don't want to in any way muddy the message in here today. So do we know why it's Lollipop Day?
Well,
is this a fundraiser by Lollipop Day?
Yeah, no, it's the Esophageal Cancer Fund run, which are a brilliant organisation that I've been working with. They organise the Lollipop Day every day just to bring awareness to it. And to reach younger people in particular, you know, like it can be run in schools. There are several schools and supermarkets that are running it as well to bring awareness and funding to the organisation.
Now, you could have swanned off into the sunset with your partner and back to school and not spoken publicly at all about it. Mm-hmm. Why were you moved to take up this and this ambassador's role and to speak publicly?
Well, to be honest, it was only really May last year that I started getting in touch with the Esophageal Cancer
Fund.
Right,
okay.
And I can just say that they have absolutely changed my outlook and, you know, viewpoint on my journey. Before that, it was an incredibly lonely experience because, you know, people going through cancers, everyone is so unique and so different and you're surrounded by people, but you're very much on your own.
Yes, of course.
And it was actually the Lollipop Day was organised in the school that I teach in down in Galway that brought my awareness to it. The student council organised it and I didn't know about the Esophageal Cancer Fund before that. And just reading their website and seeing some of the stories and testimonies, it just felt there was someone to reach out to. And it took me a while to reach out to them because you're not always ready to cross that bridge. But when I did in May last year, I went down to Limerick to one of their meetings, and to be sitting in a room of people who understood exactly the difficulties that you go through, who could give you real hands-on advice. Like I said earlier, esophageal cancer doesn't always have the most promising outlook, but I was sitting there with people who were 18 years past diagnosis and able to kind of talk to them.
And what is your prognosis now, given the timing, given the operation, given the attention to the lymph nodes, etc.?
Yeah, no, the year of immunotherapy is believed to be a big game changer within treatment. I had my last CT scan in November and that was all clear. I don't like saying the words cancer-free,
but at the moment
there is no evidence of disease. Okay. Some people think it's a bit superstitious to say within the first 5 years you're cancer-free.
Well, you know what? It's your life and it's how you want to view it. And it's funny you talk of that room with people in there. Some people want it to be a private journey and don't want to be part of a gang.
Absolutely.
Or they don't want to be called a survivor, or they don't want to. So it's individual for everyone. Mm-hmm. A caller says, my mum and brother both had it and every few years were screened for it. It is hereditary. But not say, I think really we don't want to get bogged down in that. It's about genetic links and screening and flags and stuff. I mean, obviously, if you go into a doctor with anything, the first question is there a family history? But we're speaking more from a medical perspective. Okay, listen, Jamie, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. And could I just advise anyone to keep an eye out for the lollipops being sold? I believe they're in Dunn's and Aldi.
Because that's what facilitates the likes of that important meeting that you were at.
And anyone that is going through that kind of journey, I know Donegal has a lot of people with cancer who have to travel further away for it. And so Donegal can be kind of forgotten about. If you are going through something like that, just go to the ocf.ie. And you might be able to see some advice and reach out if you
really need good URL, actually, ocf.ie. It's very easy to remember.
Five little letters.
And the lollipops might not seem as obvious as maybe it's a big daffodil, but the cause is as important. So if you are out and about, where did you say they're available?
In Dunn's and Aldi and different. I know Public School Gidore are doing a collection.
Okay, there's so you buy a lollipop and you're also supporting the work of the OCF. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Great to see you in such good form and long, long, long may it continue. Thanks so much. That's Jamie Timoney there. Mary on YouTube, well done and well said, Christine. Our farmers need supported. The first man God created was a farmer. God placed Adam in a garden. Keep up your fight for proper standards. Beth, good morning to you. Thank you for that. Another watcher says that Letterkenny Hospital is not a great place to be a patient in, especially the elderly and people who don't ask questions. It's a tragedy that a mother has to beg to have her child properly treated. Okay, thanks so much for all of your comments coming in from the various spaces that we are. Bord Bia, a caller says, the protests at Bord Bia are wasting their time. We need to block Dublin City to get anything done. Sure, RT aren't even doing any stories on them. I was listening to, I don't know if I should say, because some people are going to accuse me of sour grapes or something or other, but I was listening to some coverage this morning on the national broadcaster, and it was like, to paraphrase, it was like, well, if you give the people in poorer areas, and this was framed as outside Dublin, if you give people in poorer areas access to cheaper GP slots, sure, next thing you know, you're going to have to give them access to SNAs, and you're going to have to give them access to supports for children with additional needs. It really was a remarkable piece of audio, but I don't want to harp on about that. We're all sort of coming to terms whilst keeping on with things to the awful news that two young men, two 19-year-olds, have been killed in a collision in St Johnston. There's a third 19-year-old who was initially taken to hospital in Derry and has now been taken on to Belfast for treatment. It's after a lorry and a car collided at around about 11:15. We're joined on the programme by the Cathaoirleach of our local authority, Donegal County Council, Councillor Paul Canning. And Councillor Canning, Paul, it's just the most difficult news, isn't it? And our thoughts and our prayers and our strength or whatever we can is sent to the families and loved ones and friends of those affected by this.
Yeah, Greg, as you've stated, it's terrible news. Young people, young fellas, tragic accident last night in St Johnston, a small village. I know the guys involved are from Derry, but Derry, as you know, is the hinterland of this area, so we're all familiar with each other. So it's very sad news, you know, and our condolences are with the families and friends of those young fellas. You know, it's not something you set out to do, and it's terrible news. And it's terrible news for St Johnston as a village as well to waken up to that tragedy, like, because no doubt they'd have seen the fire brigades and the ambulances and all of them coming to the scene of the accident. And listen, a big thank you to all of the emergency services for the work that they do, because it's not easy getting called out to such tragedy, and sometimes we take the services for granted. So that as well, but it is a tragedy that nobody had planned, you know, and it's terrible news for the area. And as I said, condolences to everybody that is connected to these young boys, and I think the third fella's not out of the woods either, you know. So it's a very, very sad day for the people of this area.
Okay, Paul, thank you for that. That's the Cathaoirleach of Donegal County Council, Councillor Paul Canning, and we are sending on our best wishes too, as that young man fights for his life in the Royal Victoria Hospital in Belfast. And so important too that Councillor Paul Canning recognised our emergency services. They're just us, really. But they get the call, they don't know what they're going to turn up to, and they have to deal with the situation, and they deal with it so well, so professionally, and try and get the best outcomes for everyone impossible. Often too, the clergy have to attend a scene like this and often end up going back to a parochial house on their home. The ripples of a tragedy like this spread out far. And again, there's no words other than to say we're so sorry to hear of the incredibly, incredibly sad news. Okay, that's where we have to leave it on the Greg Hughes Show for this Wednesday, the 25th of February. Thank you very much for listening or watching. Thanks so much for texting in. Any messages I didn't get to today, I'll carry them over into the show tomorrow. Have a great Wednesday.